This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, "Happy Friday!" Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 134, Samrat, aka Meet the Neighbors number 3. It is a Meet the Neighbors special that is really stretching the definition of death of a king, because I guess we are honoring Heracles, the son of Barsine, today, and his brief, unofficial rule of the Macedonian Empire before Cassander had him killed. Regardless, I kind of have to do it this way, because there's just too much information between 308 and 301 BCE to really do it any differently. Speaking of dates, though, we need to rewind quite a bit, all the way back to episode 115, when I first introduced ancient Indian history. In that episode, I covered the evolution of northern India from a grab bag of city-states, oligarchies, and small kingdoms through the expansion of Magadha, a kingdom on the Ganges far to the east that grew into a powerful empire under the Nanda dynasty. As Magadha grew out from its capital at Pataliputra, Buddhism and Jainism were also sweeping through the northern subcontinent, competing with the established faith of the ancient Vedic hymns. Buddhism, in particular, was the most consistent faith of the Magadhan aristocracy and the kings, although there are some hints in both faiths' traditions that the Nandas, the current rulers when we left off, started favoring the Jains, if only to weaken Buddhist temple influences on politics. Technically speaking, when I covered King Dhanananda in that episode, I was actually skipping ahead just a bit, because while Alexander the Great was conquering the Western Persian Empire, the Nandas were embroiled in a period of civil strife as a succession of 8 brothers competed for power. Ironically, this turmoil probably contributed greatly to Alexander's later success in the Punjab. Dana came to power while Alexander was still fighting Sogdian warlords up in the north, and had a chance to consolidate his power before the Macedonians arrived on the banks of the Indus. But Nanda expansion into the west had stalled long enough that Alexander didn't just bumble his way into another powerful state's territory. Slowly reforming Nanda stability, and Donna's father, Mahapadma's reputation, combined with exhaustion and convinced Alexander's armies to mutiny rather than crossing into the Gangetic Plain and going to war with the Nanda Empire too, despite Alexander's personal desire. However, this did change the dynamic of northwestern India once again. By all indications, real Achaemenid influence in the Indus Valley had been slipping for most of the 4th century, and was never that direct to begin with. Plus, as I said in episode 117, Alexander may actually have pushed further into the Punjab than his Persian predecessors. It is hard to know with certainty, but the decisions and attitudes of both the Macedonians and Indians portrayed in Alexandrian sources at least suggest that people expected a Nanda invasion of what is now Pakistan by the time Alexander arrived. The Nanda succession crisis and Macedonian invasion coincided to shake up the geopolitical situation just enough for something to come loose. Two somethings, actually, and their names were Chandragupta and Chanakya. The historical sources for these two men are as numerous as they are conflicting and far removed from the events they describe. As I have said in previous episodes, India, like Iran, was not a literary culture at this point. In fact, we're actually still decades away from the first evidence of Indian writing since the Bronze Age, though we can assume that some record-keeping still circulated on perishable materials. Chandragupta and Chanakya became figures of legend, and the extant sources reflect that, making it hard to determine their exact origins. They are a lot like Cyrus the Great and his generals in that regard. In fact, some of the stories are so similar that it is hard to imagine that Persian and Greek stories of Cyrus didn't influence the story of Chandragupta. Unlike all of Indian history up to this point, the story of Chandragupta was recorded in Greco-Roman sources. Not that they are all that more reliable or less based in hearsay. Chanakya, in particular, gets wrapped up in a lot of myth-making, with Jain tradition attributing his role to a prophecy when he was born, and Buddhist legends suggesting something very similar. Kashmiri Hindu tradition depicts him as almost supernaturally vengeful. Some basic elements are consistent, though. Chanakya was considered an ugly man, known to be born with teeth already in his mouth. For whatever reason, possibly a genetic predisposition to it in some local dynasty, natal teeth were seen as an omen of royalty, or at least involvement in royalty. This is a real symptom of several disorders, though the most likely one in this case is Hallermann-Streiff syndrome, if only because it's the option with the fewest other complications that would make Chanakya's later career less plausible. Chanakya wasn't born in Magadhan territory, but that didn't mean his family feared their local rulers any less. So his parents broke those early teeth right out of his mouth, leading to further disfigurement and more of a reputation for his hideous appearance. Being considered ugly by his community did not slow young Chanakya down, though. His family was poor, but still hereditary members of the Brahmin Varna, the priestly intellectual rank of Indian society, and Chanakya studied hard, learning the Vedas by rote and studying politics. As the Nanda Empire grew, Chanakya traveled to Magadha, either the capital at Pataliputra or some nearby city seeking alms. And this is where things get a lot messier. Most of our sources are trying to tell a story, and because they are religious sources, that story is usually a morality tale. Events are compressed somewhat. Most traditions just leave it at this charitable event, but the Mudrara Kshasa, an early medieval drama, suggests that Chanakya held some sort of position in or around the royal court. And several other accounts suggest that he had some sort of familiarity with members of the Nanda family. The important part, though, is that Chanakya wasn't nobility himself or even well off. He did have just enough time in the royal orbit to get a lay of the land. Then he was kicked out for offending the king in some way. Buddhist tradition is literally that he was so ugly the king couldn't stand him. Jain tradition is more charitable and claims that he tried to rise above his station. Either way, Chanakya found himself on the run, disguised as a member of one of the smaller religious orders. According to both religious traditions, Chanakya became a practitioner of Dhatuvada, a sort of alchemy that supposedly enables you to either transform base metals into gold or multiply the gold you already have. Now, everybody's religious beliefs aside, that is not how anything works, which means one of two things. The traditional story of poor Chanakya rising from obscurity is wrong, or he did something after getting run out of Magadha to become quite wealthy. On one hand, there is a version of the story where he held position at court, so I am inclined to believe the former. On the other hand, there's also a story later in life of Chanakya using games of weighted dice to scam merchants out of their tax money, which is also an option here. In fact, there's also a story of Chanakya multiplying the number of coins that he had, turning 1 into 8, which sounds like he might have been counterfeiting. So maybe he was just a scam artist and got big off of that. Who really knows? The timeline also gets a little confusing at this point. All of these legendary sources say that Chanakya was either kicked out by Dhanananda or a king generically identified as a member of that dynasty. Unless everything else about historians' understanding of Indian history up to this point is off by decades, that doesn't make sense with what comes next. At some point during this exile, the now wealthy Chanakya encountered a child named Chandragupta. Whether he was already a young boy or hadn't even been born when Chanakya was kicked out of court depends on the source. According to some versions, Chandragupta was a peasant, and according to others, he was the son of another Nanda family member, either one of the brothers deposed before Dhana took power, or from some lesser branch of the family. In at least one description, he's just the rightful heir to the throne with no elaboration, which could imply descent from a previous dynasty before the Nandas took over. Many descriptions of this meeting depict Chandragupta playing a game of royal court, where the boy was playing at being king over the other children. If you can, cast your memories all the way back to episode 4 of this show, and remember that this is the exact same scenario where Cyrus the Great was discovered, according to Herodotus. A boy destined to be king is playing at monarchy when he is discovered by a disgruntled member of the court from an increasingly depraved king and whisked off to rise to his rightful station in grand rebellion. You can see why I personally think these stories might have influenced one another. And that is just how the story goes. Chanakya took the young Chandragupta to the most famous center of learning in all of India, Taxila. And this is where some of the Greek and Roman sources come in. To be fair to the likes of Plutarch and Pompeius Trogus, knowing that Chandragupta must have been in Taxila around the same time as Alexander, is too tempting for a writer to pass it up. And according to some tales, the teenage Chandragupta met Alexander during his conquest of the Indus Valley. It's not really likely or unlikely, it's just possible. Like, it may even just depend on what Chandragupta's real origin was, and we don't know. If he was really a prince of some kind, he probably did meet Alex. Chandragupta was educated in religion, warfare, law, and politics. And eventually, he and Chanakya moved back to Nanda territory, supposedly all the way to Pataliputra, where Chandragupta became an officer in the royal army. At least until he too offended the king. Or openly said something about being the rightful heir, which tends to offend monarchs. Personally, I think this aspect of the Chandragupta mythos reinforces the idea that he was probably an existing member of the royal family. That's really the only way you get to be an officer in this period, especially if you're associated with a rich political criminal. Regardless of the exact sequence of events up to this point, this is when myth, legend, and speculation converge with history. Backed by Chanakya's seemingly magical wealth and both men's education in military politics, the two of them began raising an army to put Chandragupta on the throne of Magadha. Where and how they did that is less clear. They did have ties to Taxila, so the northwest is possible, although that it's not very clear what their relationship was to the Macedonians or the rebel movements going on in the Indus Valley region at this time. According to some stories, Chanakya was from southern India, so maybe they went down there to raise their army. Though Chandragupta later has to conquer that region, so that also doesn't make a ton of sense. Maybe they just recruited out in every direction from more central hideouts in the Nanda countryside. Describing this army, the Roman historian Justin used the phrase, "an army of robbers," which shouldn't be taken literally, but it does imply a ragtag force of mercenaries, ne'er-do-wells, rebels, and criminals. In Jain tradition, Chanakya helps Chandragupta form an alliance with a foreign king named Parvataka, who has been linked to both Parvata, a kingdom in the Himalayan foothills, and to Poros, the Greek form of a name which we know was used by several kings in the Punjab, including Alexander's most famous Indian opponent. No matter what, though, there is a certain poetry between Chandragupta and Alexander the Great. Just as Alexander's flame sputtered out and one great conqueror passed on in 323 BC, Chandragupta Maurya launched into his career of imperial expansion as his army marched against Dhanananda for the first time. And we know almost nothing about the war that followed. The Western sources are all too brief and too far removed, just referencing that there was a war and Chandragupta won. Most of the Buddhist sources focus on Chandragupta's victory and end up making the conflict sound very brief, as if a massive army just crossed Nanda territory. The Kashmiri Hindu version attributes it all to magic. Jain sources and the Buddhist Mahavamsa provide a more plausible account of the war, though they still lack military details and focus on the legendary personal lives of Chandragupta and Chanakya. They invaded Nanda territory in 323 or 322 BCE, and rushed for the capital, capturing the outlying cities in the Gangetic Plain in the initial surprise attack, but bypassing smaller villages. This meant that they found themselves deep within enemy territory, with few local supporters or reinforcements, and hostile troops all around them. And their first major confrontation with the actual Nanda army, Chandragupta and Chanakya were soundly defeated and routed, all but disintegrating their army as they fled to the border, which border is never stated. Both the Jain accounts and the Mahavamsa tell a similar story. After this defeat, Chandragupta and his teacher were traveling through a village when they encountered a woman scolding her son. The peasant boy was trying to eat a bowl of stew or porridge and kept taking a bite from the center of the bowl and burning himself. His mother compared him to Chandragupta, taking a bite from the scalding center rather than starting with the cooling edges. According to these legends, this encounter made Chanakya realize their mistake, and when they renewed the campaign, Chandragupta seized the more disaffected border towns first to build up support and weaken the Nandas before marching on Pataliputra. This worked, and in either 322 or 320, Pataliputra was besieged. By all accounts, this second attempt came with a decisive numerical advantage for Chandragupta's side. Once Chandragupta had proven himself capable and persistent, the disaffected subjects and nobles of the Nanda Empire turned sides and helped him seize the capital. Dhanananda was forced to surrender, and according to some stories, allowed to live as an exile with whatever he could carry off in his own chariot. Longtime listeners will recognize this as similar to the stories of Cyrus the Great's defeated rivals, like Astyages, Croesus, and Nabonidus. As with all of those rivals to Cyrus, other versions of the story just have Chanakya order Dhanananda's execution, which makes more sense, since every version agrees that resistance didn't end with the capture of Pataliputra, but Dhanananda just vanishes from this point in the story. In the Jain version, where Chandragupta allied with the king Parvataka, Chanakya orchestrates Parvataka's assassination after taking the capital, so that Chandragupta can assume absolute authority and absorb Parvataka's territory. Then the battle for consolidation began, and Chandragupta spent most of the 310s BCE at war with lingering Nanda loyalists and separatist warlords, while Chanakya oversaw the reorganization of the state and dealt with nobles and merchants who refused to pay taxes. According to the fictionalized Mudrara Kshasa, all of this resistance was led by Dhanananda's former viceroy. But the same drama lists the alliance against Chandragupta as an implausible collection of peoples largely from the northwest, aka Macedonian territory and beyond. For example, Sindh, Persian Hindush or Greek India, Kashmir, Gandhara, the Sakha, as in, like, the steppe nomads, and the Greeks are all named specifically. The drama also identifies one of these allies as Megaksha of Parasika, which literally means the great king of Persia. So perhaps that account isn't very accurate to this point in time. At some point in all of this, Chandragupta did something associated with peacocks. Accounts differ on whether it had to do with the name of a city, architecture, some sort of omen, or just interesting heraldry. But the peacock became an enduring symbol of the new king and his dynasty. Chandragupta even adopted the bird as an epithet, with the Pali word Maurya. Hence, Chandragupta Maurya and the Maurya Empire. Chandragupta also adopted two new titles. India was littered with kings, called Rajas, and even great kings, Maharajas, who really weren't all that much more impressive in the grand scheme of things. Chandragupta adopted the title of his Nanda predecessors, Samrat, or Samraja, which is usually translated as emperor, but literally means king of everything. He was also declared Chakravartin, literally one whose chariot wheels move, meaning that he can ride everywhere in India undisputed. The latter title especially came to mean something like universal king, and a secular counterpart to the Buddha, or to the gods. Then, Chandragupta turned his sights on the west, and the recently independent domains of Seleucus in Iran and the Hindu Kush. But we're not going to talk about that today, because that would be returning to the main narrative, and I want to finish establishing the Maurya Empire.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
After his war with Seleucus, Chandragupta turned his attention to the south and conquered there too, until the Maurya Empire covered most of the subcontinent north of modern Kerala and Tamil Nadu. Most modern maps of this empire disguise an important detail of these conquests, though. Oddly enough, the map at the top of the Maurya Empire, on Wikipedia, does not. Chandragupta focused on the fertile farmland and urban centers, bypassing sparsely populated and tribal communities in the Thar Desert, Kigali forests and highlands, and mountain ranges. In later generations, these unconquered hinterlands would be frequent sources of resistance and rebellion. Unfortunately for us, no detailed sources for these conquests have survived. Since most of the sources for Chandragupta are religious, they are more focused on the spiritual and moral aspects of the new king's reign than the military ones. Suffice to say, he spent a lot of time conquering, but when he wasn't doing that, Chandragupta Maurya was working with Chanakya to establish a powerful centralized kingdom. They had a system of taxation, appointed governors over their provinces, and established garrison forts called Durga on the borders and internally to respond to rebels and banditry. Much of what we know about this comes from Megasthenes, a Seleucid ambassador sent to the Mauryan court who wrote detailed descriptions of his time in India. I'll give him a little more attention later on, but as usual with the most interesting writers of antiquity, Megasthenes' original indica is mostly lost today, known through citations and other works. Megasthenes' indica acts as a more narrative complement to another, surviving, eyewitness source, though. Chanakya himself. Chanakya wrote the Arthashastra, a Sanskrit guide on how to run a kingdom, which miraculously was copied and recopied thoroughly enough for a single manuscript to survive into the early 20th century. The Arthashastra is partly a guide to the ideal government, but must reflect some of the genuine laws and taxation policies implemented by its author. Together, Chanakya and Megasthenes describe an incredibly centralized and complex system that covered everything from institutionalized assassination, anti-choice abortion law, tax policy, labor rights, animal welfare, foreign policy, and infrastructure. Chandragupta ruled as a king, but he had a council of ministers and advisors, headed by Chanakya as his premier. Beneath this council, there were parallel tracks of government and distinct legal codes for different aspects of society, very loosely reflecting the Varnas themselves. Rural villages had their own central administrative arm that monitored things like farm equipment, forestry, and agriculture. Urban centers had a government apparatus dedicated to infrastructure, trade, manufacturing, and foreign relations. The military had its own distinct administrative system, from the central government to ensure things like training and equipment. Most notably to Megasthenes, all of these different arms of the government were heavily invested in establishing India's own equivalent to the Persian Royal Road, potentially even inspired by the army's time in the West. This network of well-maintained roads would go on to facilitate trade, both internal and with the Seleucids, and further military conquest by subsequent generations. Religiously, Chandragupta continued long-standing Magadha tradition. He heavily patronized Buddhism, and his descendants would eventually become hardline Buddhists to the detriment of other faiths. But for now, under Chandragupta himself, the king continued to participate in tradition Brahmanic rituals from the Vedas, and the Jains, Ajivikas, Shivaists, and other new religious movements flourished and grew, permanently enhancing Chandragupta and Chanakya in the eyes of religious chroniclers from all stripes. Chandragupta's son, Bindusara, ultimately succeeded him in 297 BC, and was in turn followed by Ashoka, who saw the Mauryan Empire reach its greatest extent around 261. But that might be taking this episode a little further than necessary. Until the latter half of Ashoka's reign, Chandragupta's successors stayed the course, following Chanakya's advice in the Arthashastra and their founder's policies, continuing to expand the empire and to deal harshly with rebels. We will see them again, but first, we need to go back to the narrative and establish our own Seleucid Empire. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you'll find things like maps, my bibliography, and the financial support page. If you just want to hear more of my voice, check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem. The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico. How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.